Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 11, delivered on September 29, 2010. The title of this lecture is Time Value of Money.
Today, the time value of money. This is the first of two lectures on the topic of time value of money. In this lecture, I provide you with the basics, the essential formula, and also some terminology. Some of this is old school terminology that they might not use so much in the textbook, but it's old school when I say lump sum as opposed to an annuity. But that will come as we develop the topic today. The second lecture will get into more complex cash flows other than just plain old lump sums of money moving forward in time and back in time. I can assure you that these problems, even with basic formulas, can get extraordinarily complicated to the point where I can't even figure out whether I've got the right answer or not. And it can get bad with these, and I don't take it as far as some professors do, because it's just like it's just testing to see where I can break your will to live, which isn't so bad, but I don't like having my tires slashed on my car. Although I'll give you some that are a little more complicated, this can get to be a real pain in the butt subject. Two things that I want to encourage you to always have handy is, first of all, always have your calculator with you, because in the old days we used tables and slide rules to do this kind of work. The tables are still around, but we don't use those so much anymore. This stuff can be done very quickly on a calculator, either algebraically or with the financial functions that are available on the calculators that we have today. The other thing is also, and it sounds a little weird, always have your ruler around too, because timelines really help you with this, with doing problems, especially when you get into cash flows that have different values at different points in times. Drawing out a timeline can save your bacon. It does mine. I use these timelines all the time. You'll see me doing it definitely on Monday you'll see me do that. But for right now, I want to get down to get to the real core essentials of the time value of money. Now, what I am going to show you here, you have seen before in a completely different context, earlier in your lives, in the dark days of high school and junior high school, and even possibly elementary school, although I don't know that they would do it there. You were doing this, except you were doing it with a more simple kind of mechanism, with things that don't sound like they have anything to do with finance at all. Do you remember a long time ago in your dark past where they taught you how to do unit conversions? How you convert, say, inches to centimeters or something like that? Remember that 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters. So if I were to say, for example, well, how many centimeters are in 5 inches, what you would do is you would write 5 inches, and then you would take that formula, 1 inch equals 2.54 centimeters, and you would just write it as a fraction, whichever way would make the desired units stay and the undesired units go away. And there you are. You would be able to do the conversion. It would be 5 inches times 2.54 centimeters per inch. Or, on the other hand, how many inches are in 12 centimeters you would just write 12 centimeters, and then you would take your unit conversion and you would just write it as a fraction the way, again, that would make the desired units stay and the undesired units go away. And in this case, you would put the centimeters of the unit conversion on the bottom so they cancel. But that was converting from one unit to another unit. You saw this in your past. That's what we're going to do here. That's how we do time value of money. The difference is that in finance, the unit conversion is not a fixed value. It changes based upon time and the interest rate that we're going to use for discounting. But that's what we're doing. We're actually changing, say, for example, dollars now to dollars 5 years from now. And we're using a unit conversion to do it. And there's a unit conversion formula. Like I said, it will include time and interest rate, which your simple unit conversions didn't do when you were learning this the first time. But at the end of the day, we're just doing conversions of dollars now or dollars some other time to dollars in another time frame. Now, that might sound a little odd, but what I want to do in saying that is I want to give you the sense that there really is an anchor. This isn't a totally new topic to you. But at the beginning of this, I have to make sure that we have a few basic ideas. Okay, woman, I'm going to give you $100. No, stop it. $100. You want it now or do you want it in a year?
No.
Well, duh, yeah. Why?
So I can use it.
Oh, because in a year there would be an opportunity cost. You would have to forego consumption for a year. So you would want to, you would say, well, I can't. If I'm going to have it in a year, I would want a compensation for having it in a year. Okay, now you see in finance, we have to include that opportunity cost of giving up now money to the future. And the compensation factor, the opportunity cost, is an interest rate. That interest rate is going to change based upon the riskiness with which you are going to wait for your money. Here's the first formula that we work with. It is a conversion formula for a lump of money, between present and future. The future value of a lump of money, just a wad of money, a pile of dollars, is going to be its present value, its now value, wait a minute, excuse me, times 1 plus the periodic interest rate to the number of periods. R is the periodic interest rate, and N is the number of periods. And the FV is the future value of the lump sum of money, and PV is the present value of the lump of money. It's actually a preciously simple formula. Very easy, but it contains such a wallop. Now, generally speaking, when I give you an interest rate, almost always, anyone who gives you an interest rate is going to give you an annual interest rate. So you remember that you're going to have to adjust that annual interest rate to periodic interest rate. So, for example, if I were to tell you that the annual interest rate is 8% for 5 years. Well, R would be 8 and N would be 5. But if I were to tell you that the compounding was semi-annual, then I would have to say, oh, semi-annual means twice every year. So that would mean with semi-annual compounding, the interest rate would be 4% per period per each 6 months, and the number of periods would be 10. Be sure you make the adjustment appropriately. If I were to tell you that it was monthly, I'm going to be so sorry I used 8% there. It would be 8% divided by 12. See, I didn't even do the calculation. 4, 5 times 12 periods. So in other words, with semi-annual, you would divide the interest rate by 2 and multiply the years by 2. With monthly, you would divide the interest rate by 12 and multiply the number of periods by 12, years by 12. What about weekly? What would it be weekly? Go ahead, make my day. 52. So I would divide the interest rate by 52 and multiply the number of years by 52. Now, daily, what would it be? I would divide the interest rate by and multiply the number of periods by? No. Wait, what? I warned you, I am old school. Believe it or not, you divide the interest rate by 360 and multiply the number of years by 365. And I know, I can guarantee you the textbook will, you can read the textbook. Don't listen to Professor Kring, he's on crack. You see, in the old days, we did it that way. 360 was the divisor for the interest rate. 365 was the multiplier for the number of years. You know why we did the 360? You know what 360 was? It was very common in financial calculations until very recently in time. I was still teaching at a standard easily 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. Where does the 360 come from? Why 360? Does anyone know that one? You know. You haven't ever been shown this yet in a business course, right? Yeah? Yeah. 5 bank holidays a year. 360. Now, the real reason was because before there were calculators, the number 360 has a trick for how you can divide it fast in your head. There was actually, and that was a real reason, but our justified reason was 5 banker holidays a year was the 360. So divided by 360 was technically because of the banker's holidays and also more practically because 360 is an easier number to divide by than 365. Okay, so to this day, I still encourage you. You don't have to. God knows. You don't have to listen to me. But the 360 is old school stuff for dividing the interest rate. Okay, but whatever way you're going to do it, and I will be very specific about what I want you to do on an exam. But know that you make sure that you are dealing with compounding properly in the formula. So, you invest $25,000 in an account that pays 9.3% interest compounded biweekly. How much will you have in the account in 10 years? I get you right down to doing math, the calculations. And really, at this level of the problem, it's faster to do it algebraically than to try to push it into your calculator as a financial function. Just doing it algebraically on your calculator is a lot faster. Now, in problems like this, it will do you all kinds of wonderful good to know what it is you know and what it is you don't know, so that you can just stuff the numbers into the formula. In this case, the periodic interest rate will be what? As a matter of fact, what the hell, what will it be? What is the calculation I have to do? Well, let's just make sure that we're going to do it with the decimals. 0.093 divided by what? 104. Bi-weekly would be? Yeah, every 2 weeks. Now, I warn you, be careful about rounding on these. It's better to just chain this in as a single calculation on your calculator than to try to round it and then pump it in. But I am going to write the number out here. Anyway, 0.093 divided by 26. Survey says 0.0035357-69231. And I'm just going to write that like that, but I caution you, don't try to do it that way. You're wasting time writing numbers down and then keying them back in. It's best if you just pump the formula in all at once. But the number of periods in this case would be 10 times 26, or 260. Now, you need to know whether it is the future value or the present value that we know. In this case, I said you invest $25,000. That means that you have that money now. I know the now money. The now money is what I know, and that is $25,000. And it is the FV that I don't know. Now, this sounds trifling, but it is not. Because sometimes you'll know the now value, sometimes you'll know the then value. In this case, we're going to calculate a future value. So in this case, what will come out of this is I'm just going to put it in as a formula, right? Stuff it into the formula. I'm going to have that the future value, I don't know, is the present value, $25,000. Times 1 plus 0.093 over 26 to the, in parentheses, 10 times 26 power. Strongly recommend that you chain it in like that and be careful about hierarchy of operations. If you're using a TI-83, you're in good business. I caution you with these business calculators like the BA-2, they default to a mode where they don't know hierarchy of operations. In other words, they don't know that a times comes before a plus. You can change them so that they do recognize it, but in default mode, they will really give you wrong answers consistently. So if you're with a TI-83 or a TI-83 plus TI-84, you're in great shape with these. And you can just pour that in there. And if you do that with this thing, and I'm going to just push it in myself, times 1 plus 0.093 divided by 26 to the, open parenthesis, 10 times 26, close parenthesis, I get $63,257.68. 68. Now, reality check time. always with these questions, with these problems, ask yourself, does this answer make sense? One nice thing is that if you screw the pooch on this, you use the wrong formula or you put in a number the wrong way, your number, your answer will look wrong in a common sense kind of way. You'll get numbers that are in the millions or you'll get numbers that are just decimals. It's, in other words, these formulas are sensitive to mistakes. So if you're looking at your answer, just say, if I put 25 grand, that's a good interest rate. I'm going to put 25 grand in the bank. I'm not going to touch it for 10 years. Yeah, that probably that looks about right. That's okay. We're okay there. Okay? That's the nice thing about that. Okay? So there you are. 63,000. These problems aren't that hard. Let me show you something interesting about this. You see that periodic interest rate, 0.093 divided by 26, comes out to be 0.00357692031. That is the interest rate for each period. It would be nice if we knew what the equivalent of that interest rate was on an annual basis. It's not going to be 9.3%. It's going to be a little more than that. Here's what we do. Now you want to write this down. We're going to calculate what we call the effective yield. The effective yield. Just take one plus 0.093 over 26 to the 10 times 20, to the 26th power. And then subtract 1. And obviously multiply the result by 100% to get it as a percentage. Do that for me. What do you get? One plus 0.093 divided by 26 to the 26th power minus 1 times 100%. 100 just multiplying by 100 just turns it back into a percent. What do you get? Make sure you can do this yourselves because I will ask this on the exam, I promise. Is that what you get? 9.73%, or did I do something? Is that what you get? Okay, 9.73%. That's called the effective yield. That is the number that you could have put in over here instead of 0.093 divided by 26 to the 260. In other words, that number right there would have allowed you to have said 25,000 times 1 plus 0.0973 to the 10th power and gotten the same answer. Now let me tell you why what this is all about historically. But first of all, it'll come out to be a little off because I'm rounding there. But here's the deal. Back before the crash of 29, banks were just going stupid crazy. I mean, there was just no control whatsoever on the banking industry. There had been ridiculous runs on banks in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Just insanity was reigning. Bad banks would cause good banks to collapse. And there was a lack of regulatory oversight. And then the Federal Reserve Act was passed to have the Federal Reserve oversee this whole mess and get it under control. And they turned into a bunch of fails in the 1920s. Businesses had fun and no one was controlling them. And it just turned into a mess. Banks were offering the moon to investors, ridiculous interest rates and all of this kind of stuff. And of course, we had a massive disaster financially at the end of the 1920s, which largely caused the Great Depression. And as part of the cleaning up of the whole system, which was brought about when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was brought into power with a very, very aggressive slate of new legislators. They passed laws to control the securities industry, the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And they also passed banking laws that essentially put a fist down on the banking industry and said, no more of your stupid ass games. Those banking industry laws were highly effective for many years, and then because of the screaming and crying and bawling of the banking industry in the 1990s, those regulations were finally began to shake loose, and they were pretty much gone by the beginning of the 21st century. And hence, lo and behold, we had a major financial catastrophe in 2008, in September of 2008. Which would have made, if it had gone any much further than it did, would have made the crash of 29 look like a cakewalk. But nonetheless, when these banking reforms were put in, one of the things that they said or they required was that no bank offer more than 5.25% interest. You can't promise the moon to people who save at your bank. You can't do that. The most you can offer is 5.25% interest. Essentially, in economics, we would call that a price ceiling. Well, banks were pretty much, well, okay, yes, we've screwed up. But over time, there really was competitive pressure to try to offer customers, savers, more at the banks. But they were limited by that 5.25% passbook rate. So what did they do? They looked at the law and they said, well, it doesn't say how many times a year we can compound that 5.25%. So you see what happens is that when you compound any interest rate, it makes it effectively a higher interest rate. So began the era when you saw compounding was as a way of circumventing the spirit, if not the letter, of a law putting a price ceiling on interest rates. As you can see here, by compounding biweekly, you actually are providing savers with 9.73% interest instead of 9.3% interest. It's kind of a cool trick, and that's just a little historical aside. Now, it can get to the point where it can get just totally stupid. You can get compounding weekly, compounding daily. And there is actually even compounding instantaneously. The formula for compounding instantaneously is actually not the same as these. It's a limit, and I don't get into that in this course. And part of why I don't get into that is because you will never be a large enough investor that you will qualify for instantaneous compounding. Now, let's try something else here. In one way, I'm almost reticent to show you the flip side formula. Because really, see that FV equals PV times 1 plus R to the N? That really is all you would ever need. But you see, I could write it the other way and say that PV is FV over 1 plus R to the N. So that I could find the present value if I knew a future value of money. I mean, it's like you really don't need to know that formula because you could just plug that one in and algebraically work it out. Another way, by the way, to write this, you'll see me do this, is you know that if you have something, a denominator to a power, that's the same as writing that as a numerator to the negative of that power. So the present value is the future value, PV equals FV, times the quantity 1 plus R to the negative N. You'll see me write it that way. It's a little more compact representation. They're saying the same thing, and really they're the same as over there. Madam, You want to retire someday. When you retire, you want to have $1 million. So let's say that you would like to work for 40 years and then retire. And you are asking yourself, all right, what would I have to put into this savings account right now so that I'd have $1 million in 40 years? So that you could be a millionaire when you retire. Well, let's say that the account would be, let's say that you could put your money in. If you promised to keep it for 40 years, you could put your money into an account that would pay you 7.4%. How much money would you have to put in to an account paying 7.4% compounded monthly so you would have $1 million in 40 years. Kind of an interesting question there. Because you see, this is the beginning, the very beginning of a whole field called financial planning, where we can actually sit down with people and say, okay, you want to have the money so that you can pay your kid's college education. Your kid was just born and you want to have the money for the tuition when the kid hits 18. We can work it out fairly well as long as our client stays disciplined to a program. We can say how much you put in now or how much would you put in every month, and we'll do that on Monday, the annuities. But look here. In this case, remember that we always... The parts of these formulas are PV, FV, R, and D. Or R and N. I'm sorry, I use the D's a little later. Not sure I will this time. But, okay, we have the... the R is going to be pretty easy. It's 7.4%, 0.074 divided by 12 monthly. And then the N is going to be... 40 years times 12 months a year, which is 480 months. Now, PV and FV, in this case, we know the future value. We know the target value out there 40 years from now. So we know the FV this time. It is $1 million. What we don't know this time is the present now value. What do we have to have now so that we can apply the proper unit conversion to get the future? Well, that would mean that we could use this PV formula. Actually, you could use that one over there. You just have to do the algebra in it. But we can use the PV formula here, whichever way you want to do it. But the present value that we want is going to be $1 million times 1 plus 0.074 over 12 to the negative, in this case, 40 times 12. And make sure that if you're going to calculate that, you put parentheses in the right places. You can, like I said, though, the good thing is that if you screw up a parenthesis or something like that, it really shines through and you get an answer that's so obviously wrong. So if I were to honk this out, and I want you to make sure you can get this number yourselves so that it's not, well, how did he get that? Do it now so that you can see how it's, that you can get the number. You would take 1 million... times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.074 divided by 12, close the parenthesis, raise it to the power, and put the negative sign on, and then close open parenthesis, 40 times 12. Close the parenthesis, and the survey says, what do you get? Yeah, about 52,292.06. First things first, reality check. It's not some enormous, ridiculously ginormous number, and it is also not some tiny little decimal number. So it's probably you've done it, at least most likely you've done it right. Second thing is notice, now we're back to you now. You are going to retire in 40 years, you want to be a millionaire. If you put in $52,292.06 in the bank now, you will live your dream of having $1 million when you retire. That sounds actually not bad. Of course, the downside is that $1 million will buy you a loaf of bread and a pot pie in 40 years. But you see, one of the interesting things about this is notice how this effect of interest rate and the compounding process does have an awesome effect over time. It allows money to grow so that I can say that ultimately the $52,000, if you are smart enough and you can do that, putting that in the bank and just leaving it there, forgetting about it, it will, by the process of interest rate growth of principal, make a little bit of money, a reasonably small amount of money, into a pretty decent pile of money. Last thing, let's do the effective yield, just to get the effective yield for this one. And again, all you would do is 1 plus 0.074 over 12 to the 12th power, minus 1, and then times the result by 100%. Just make sure you can do it, and I'm doing it here so that you have a good example, so that, clear. 1 plus 0.074, close the parenthesis, raise it to the 12th power, subtract 1, my ass, what did I do wrong there? I can't even see what I'm doing right now. Clear that out. Clear. 1 plus 0.074 divided by 12, close parenthesis, raise that to the 12th power, subtract 1, and then multiply the result by 100. Rounded to two decimal places, you should get 7.66%. So in other words, if I had wanted to, instead of using for the present value I calculated, 1 plus 0.074 to the over 12 to the negative 40 times 12, I could have done 1 million times 1 plus 0.0766 to the negative 40th power and gotten the same answer. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.